This is that hour when we all get humble again. For 1 hour, anyway. We might not take it home with us. We might not keep it until Thursday night, but we're going to get humble for an hour, anyway. And speaking of humility, we've got a little gal here that came into this program, and they give her that golden chariot that I'm talking about. She took it out and kicked the wheels off of it. And then she found out about this humility and this higher power. And I think she can probably tell you more about that than I can. So Gert, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the prayer, Dave. I was one of those who fell by the wayside. And I am indeed grateful to be back tonight, sober. I don't sound like a happy alcoholic, but I am. I'm just so full of gratefulness that I can't seem to express it. I don't even know what I'm going to talk about. This is my first talk since I slipped 3.5 years ago. This is my first honest moment at an open meeting and my first talk. My name is Gert Christensen, and I am an alcoholic, all the way in and out. I have completely surrendered my will to a higher power. I know I can never take another drink again as long as I live, because I know I have had my last chance at ever coming back to you among the living. Just before I started, I was going to start out with a few jokes and everything else. I guess it isn't supposed to be that way. But I had asked God's help for tonight so that I could help someone out there that has gone down the same road that I have, after having found this program and the happiness that you can find in it if you practice the 12 steps to the best of your ability. When I first found you good people here in Michigan, I was very much deep into this alcoholism, into this disease. I was a very, very sick gal. But I must go back a few moments of before I came to Michigan and how I got here and how I found you. I heard of you first in 1947. The seed was planted then, which is 15 years ago. But it never took. In New York City, where I first heard of AA, I had to go through Bellevue 3 times in restraints. I fought cops, anybody that was a little bit bigger than me. I have a terrible temper, and I'm a terrible person when I'm drinking and under the influence of alcohol. I was in the state hospital for 3 times. The third and last time I was in, I banged on a door, begging them, please open up and let me in, because I knew that I wanted to quit drinking and I didn't know how, even though I had heard of you. It did not sink in. Nothing sank in. But I knew that if I got locked up behind the bars, I could not reach a drink. The last time that I was in the state hospital, I was absolutely alone in this world. I had no one, not a soul, because my mother had already left me to go back to Copenhagen, Denmark. Her parting words to me were on the boat as she left, "My little girl," she said, "I must leave you because I must save my own sanity. Because I cannot stand to see the only child that I have die in a drunkard's grave." Those were the last words my mother said to me as she left me. My mother gave me a $10 bill and had paid a 2 weeks' rent for me at a rooming house. She said, "It's entirely up to you, Gerd." She could have given me more money, but she knew that I would take this 10 and go down to Warren Street in New York and get a job and straighten out, or I would take the 10 and go out and get drunk or start one. And no matter whether it was 35 cents or a dime at that time and you get a beer, all I needed was entrance fee. That was all I needed. My mother was gone 6 days, and on that 6th day was when I was banging out in Long Island, Kings Park State Hospital, "Please let me in." I have no one to sign me out of this hospital. I had no one but myself. But there was a way of getting out, and as being an alcoholic, I was quick to find out that if you volunteered to work in a nursing home, you could get out and be on a probation for a year. I immediately grasped onto this idea and told all the doctors how wonderful I was going to be and not drink anymore. And after being locked up for a little more than 2 months, they let me out to work in this nursing home. At this nursing home, I took one look, and they were going to pay me $40 a month in room and board. There were no bars in the windows. I was completely free to go as I pleased. And I saw what I was going to have to do. And I figured that all I got to do is wait out a month to get my pay, and I will skip this place and fast. Things did not work out that way. They weren't supposed to. That following Friday, there was also a little meeting, just like this one. Only it happened to be a closed one. And there were two other girls working at this same nursing home who had also been in the state hospital. And they said to me, "Gerd, would you like to go along with us to a meeting tonight?" I had no money. I had nothing else to do. So I said yes. And we went to this little basement of this little church in Kings Park, Long Island. And there, people greeted me. They were warm. "Would you like a cup of coffee?" "My name is so-and-so. What's yours?" They knew I had just come from the state hospital, but they didn't care. Did I want to do something about my drinking? I didn't know. I really didn't know. But I sat and listened for the first time in my life. I liked these people, and they seemed to do something to me. And lo and behold, the first month came by. I did not take my first paycheck and skip. I stuck around, and I went to this little meeting continually, the open and the closed. Then they started to come and didn't get me. Of course, I had no car. And we went to other meetings. I started to enjoy this way of life. It was indeed different. I wasn't drinking, and I was holding on. As I said before, it was supposed to take 1 year before I could be completely free of the bonds of the state hospital. Inside of 9 to 10 months, I found out that I could get a very good job out there in a place called Link's Restaurant. It will be good for my lawyer from $100 to $125 a week. Now, that's quite a large amount of money when you're making $40 a month. Although by this time I was making $60. I went to my superior and I said to her, "Do you think it is possible for me to go to work at Link's Restaurant?" And she says, "Gerd, you have been doing a good job here and you have been sticking with AA. I see no reason that it cannot be arranged." She went out on a limb for me, and before my year was up, I was working at Link's. Inside of 2 weeks, I had a beautiful little apartment. Inside the 3rd week, I had a little off-beat car. That's how quick it went. I continued to go to my meetings, and for 14 solid months, I stayed sober. I never took a drink. On this job, I started to like the smell of what I was serving. And one night, these bunch of waitresses, there was about 30 or 35 of them, it's a large restaurant, they said, "Gerd, come along with us, we're going out and have a few drinks, and come on, you're so full of fun and all this, let's go out and have a ball." I said, "Well, I don't drink." "Well, that's all right, come along anyway." So I went along, and lo and behold, I had a ball that night, drinking 7-Up. I switched over to Coke. And I was doing great. I mean, everybody slapped me on the back. "Gee, this is wonderful. How you can stand there and you can come up and dance and have a good time and tell jokes and still not drink." And this, I thought, was pretty good myself. Finally, I found out that I like to go out with these girls on my meeting nights and their husbands and a fellow that I met. And things were going pretty well. Finally, I started to go back to a meeting one night because there was a certain person I wanted to hear speak whom I liked very much. But I sat out there as you were sitting. The chair was very uncomfortable. I didn't particularly like what he said. I wasn't very fond of the people that I was associating with. I wanted to be with that gang over there. And as you know what would happen, it says in the Lord's Prayer, "Lead us not into temptation." It says in the big book, "Do not be in a bar unless you're darn sure of yourself and you have a reason to be there." But you see, I had never read the big book in those 14 months. And would you believe me if I told you that I didn't even read the 12 steps? This is God's truth. I'm standing up here and I'm being honest with you. The word God in New York City to the meetings that I went to was whispered. It was not spoken aloud because you might scare the newcomer away. This is truth too. I said to Our Father after every meeting, just like everybody else, I mumbled them, but I didn't pay heed to what the words were. "Oh, I'm not going to go in and drag this thing out. After 14 months, I picked up a drink. And I was worse on that drunk than I was 14 months previous. Within 5 days, I lost my home, my job, and smashed my car. Would you also believe that I didn't have a driver's license? I had a driver's permit. And someone was supposed to be with me. But when I smacked up this little car of mine, I was just as drunk as I could be. No license. Came to with cops all over the place. 2 broken ribs. My eye completely smacked in. my nose bleeding, and my kneecap hanging out. 5 days. You'd think you'd learn, wouldn't you? Well, make a long story short on that episode, I couldn't work. I thought it was Dot Young's place who runs the rest home after they found me. And after I was able to move around a bit, I stuck around with Dot for about 8 months. That was all AA. I still didn't learn anything. I still blanked. Next thing I knew, I was in Florida. And there I really went on one. I was so drunk there, and so sick, and again alone, and didn't even know a damn thing about AA, not a thing. You know, these astronauts that this country has paid $2 billion for these men, to be up there in space in orbit, I was like that continually. I would get like down 35 cent sneaky feet to get me a pint of wine. I was weightless, you know? I couldn't hold on to nothing. Talk about the instrument flying, I was it. I was like a zombie. I was like an animal. I lived like one. I finally skating around a bit. Went to work in this little restaurant in Florida and met Ellen. I told her I was an alcoholic. I was very proud of the fact. I thought I'd better tell her I was an alcoholic before she called me a drunk. She says, well, that's perfectly all right. I know a little bit about it. She doesn't mind me saying this. Because my dad's an alcoholic. So I understand the problem a little bit. I says, well, gee, that's wonderful. You see, I can't take too much to drink, just a little bit. Now, you understand that part. She says, oh, yes, I do. I says, fine. I says, as long as I only drink a little bit of beer every now and then, everything will be all right. Well, she found out what a little bit of beer did to me. Weighed a little bit of whiskey. And we mixed them up a little bit. And I lost my job again. But I really didn't have too much of a problem with it. I can remember one time my episode in New York, just going back a little bit, telling my mother, the first time I ended in Bellevue, I was black and blue from head to foot. And I was in restraints. I'd never been in Bellevue in my life. I mean, these things could never happen to me, you know. I could never end up in a psychiatry ward. A psychiatric, whatever you call it. And smell the high heaven of this stuff called formaldehyde. And as I came to, I looked up and there were these two attendants standing looking down at me and saying, we can let this one up now, she'll be all right. She's calmed down. I thought, my God, what has happened to me? What building fell on me, you know? I felt terrible. And the taste. Well, I started walking around and I found myself in one of these rooms. Well, they opened from the back, you know, and that's it. I'm out of here. And I sat down, the bench was cold, your head, and it was too short and too... It's embarrassing, but anyway, everybody else is running around like that, so you got used to it in a few minutes. As God is my witness, I didn't know why I was there. I didn't remember anything. But I knew I was in trouble. Finally, I heard my name being called. And I got up and I said, what's the matter? What is it? And I was supposed to go and see this little doctor. I called him a little doctor because he was a little man. He was a little intern. And he said to me, young lady, he said, do you know what you did last night? I said, no, sir. He said, do you know why you're here? I said, no, doctor. I didn't. It seems I made quite a ruckus. lived on the fifth floor. I threw a chair out the back window. Raised hell with my mother because there wasn't enough booze in the house. And then I called the police. I had fought four of them. The strength I had, oh my goodness. What a lady, huh? This doctor is reading all this, reading on this little stuff that he's been, that they have written down about me, and I'm looking at him in amazement that why do I remember this? He said, do you know the drinking caused this? And I says, drinking? And I says, no, doctor, I don't realize it. He says, don't you think that you'd better do something about your drinking? I said, yes, doctor. I want it out, you know. So I promised him I was definitely going to do something about my drinking. In 5 days, they released me to my mother before she left for Denmark. As we're walking down the street on 23rd Street and catching a bus, I said, you know, Mom? I said, that doctor is right. I've got to do something about my drinking, and I'm going to. My mother had the most pleased look on her face. She says to me, Danny, she says, you know, honey, she says, that's good. She says, what are you going to do? I says, as God is my witness, I will never again go into a bar and order a shot of whiskey with a beer chaser. From now on, it's either going to be whiskey alone or beer. It's a mixture of two. It's funny. I can laugh at it today. How ignorant can we be? How long does it take to find out what we are? How long does it take to go through hell on earth to find out that we can live another way? That there is a new way of life. How many times must we knock our head against a cement wall to find out that there is only one way for the alcoholic? That is to come into AA with an open mind, become willing to do whatever any older member tells you to do. Do it with an open mind. Listen to the older guy. And try and learn. Become honest with yourself and your fellow man. When Al and I left Florida, we were going back to New York. She asked me if I would be so kind as to come here to Michigan to meet her mother and family. I had no ties. So I came here to Michigan. I met her mother and her family, and I loved them immediately. And they loved me, and her mother adopted me as another daughter. We had a nice little apartment, and Al and I got a nice little job over at Devon Gables. My drinking continued. Finally, one time, I had a very, very sick time of it. And I had taken time off from work at Devon Gables, and Ellen had covered up for me, as she always had done. And I knew I was so sick that I had to have a doctor. There was no doctor going to come out at midnight to a drunk. But if any of you old-timers around here remember a Dr. Peake, he came out to see me, all the way from Detroit. And this man gave me a shot, told me to calm down, said, you'll live through it. And I thought, boy, he's awful calm about this whole bit. I'm dying, and he's sitting there, I'll come through it. But anyway, I went into bed, then he came in on his crutches. And he looked down at me, and he says, have you ever tried AA? I says, oh, no. Don't give me that. I said, I'm different. I don't belong in AA. I don't belong with these people. And he said, sponsors. I'm an AA. With that, I went to sleep. Whole lot of people waited around for me for quite a while. But finally, he got me down to Ferndale. To a closed meeting on a Monday night. And what do you think? I sat down at a table something like this. I had never been to a closed meeting like this in my life. They're talking on steps. Big men like the size of Pete, Jack, Ted, talking about God. And to turn their will, I said, what have I got into here? Don't they know I'm a newcomer? They're going to scare me away with this stuff. That's the truth. I left that night with Dr. Peach and he took me home to Pontiac. He said, what do you think you're needing? I said, it's fine for you. It's fine for all those people who want to go into religion. And as Ellen can verify, if she's sitting here tonight, I went back in that little apartment and I opened up a can of beer and had it. Because I could not understand this God stuff. I was afraid of it. Another drunk, and another time to be sick. This time I called Dr. Peake and said, I'd like to try this bit one more time. And Larry Lawson was called in Arlena. They came out to get me and took me to a Sunday morning meeting in Pontiac. Scotty was alive, Doc Cobb, Larry. What a meeting. Bert Murdoch, all of that gang was there. And this time they spoke about God. But I wanted it. I really wanted it. And I listened. And I started again to try this program. I tried very hard. I became as honest as I could be. I started to say prayers and just a little more about God. I wasn't ashamed of it anymore. I started to understand a little more about these steps. I'm not rationalizing or making excuses. I glanced at the big book. Matter of fact, Ted told me the other night that I got on the drunk there after 18 months and I threw all the stuff out and he had that book. And he says, you must have looked at it, you must have, because there are lines around certain pages. But I don't remember it. I had 18 months of very, very happy sobriety here in Michigan. I loved my groups. I went to as many as 7 and 8 meetings a week. None of them bored me. Believe me. Somewhere along the line, I had to have a foot operation. They told me, when you go to a doctor, be honest. Tell them you're an alcoholic. I told this doctor I was an alcoholic. I said, whatever you give me, when you get ready to do those feet of mine, be sure it isn't anything that will set up a compulsion to drink. He says, don't worry about it. One of my very best friends who is a doctor is also an alcoholic. Unbeknownst to me, he shot me full of Demerol. I found out later from Dr. Cobb that was one of the worst narcotic an alcoholic can get. My feet were operated on. When I came home, Larry was there. And he and Tom, Helen's stepdad, carried me into the apartment. I went through a lot of pain with my feet. I would never go through such a thing again. I'll take the corns anytime. It was awful. But I was also taking Demerol by pill form at that particular time, still not knowing it was Demerol. Until I found out through the pharmacist that Ellen went to. I woke up this particular evening and I wanted to drink so bad that it was awful, and I had not had this desire in 18 months. I begged down the room to Tom's closet to see if there wasn't a drink in there. She started to make me coffee. And I was crying and feeling sorry, and I was in this pain. I'm the only one in the world that's suffering. I said, please, all I want is a drink. I didn't pray. I didn't say, God, help me. Help me to get over this a little bit. All I sat there, or laid there, I should say, is, oh, man, I'm suffering. Poor me. But I got through, I would say, about 2 weeks ago. Went back to work too quick. And before you knew it, I was drunk. Where had I gone astray? Where? Kate is my sponsor. I picked her out of the Ferndale group, which is my home group. This is my home group, too. She said in a talk one night, she says, you guys and gals who go out on these road tests, can't you possibly tell us the heavens? What goes wrong? Why? So that we won't make the same mistake. What can you tell someone 10, 12, 15 years of sobriety? Never having a sip. What can you tell these people? I can say this. The 12 steps, 24 hours, the big book, and meetings. Don't be ashamed to open up at a meeting. If something is bothering you, talk it out. For God's sake, don't hold resentments. We can't afford it. Turn your life and will over the care of God to the best of your ability. In the 18 months that I was sober, I did another thing. I judged others. I couldn't understand people getting into little corners and telling dirty stories. I really couldn't. I said, how can they stay sober? I am not to judge anyone because I do not want to be judged by you. There is only one judge, and that is God Almighty. In my book. Now I have found a certain sense of balance. I can tell a little story now and then. I like them. I want my sense of humor. I have to go out into this world and work. I'm not amongst you 24 hours a day. I am not working with you. I have to work in a restaurant, in a dining room, where there are no alcoholics. By this, I mean I'm not working with one. So I must learn to understand the other person, to love the other person. I must learn how to control my greed, my egotism, my jealousy, my temper. My impatience. All these things I must learn. I'm getting better. But it's a long, long road. It isn't easy. And anybody who says it's easy is a liar, in my book. Until the day comes when you can completely say everything is perfect, I'm afraid you'll be standing over your grave. Because we have to face facts every day in our life. I still lose my temper. I lost it once and real bad down in Florida this year. I was like a little child of 3 years old stomping my feet. I call another waitress every dirty, filthy name that I can. I'm sober. I haven't had a drink. But I reverted back. And she's calling me the same thing. Over a piece of wood, there was a cart that was maybe twice the size of this that was in the kitchen. And it was up this high. And it was to help the waitresses who could not handle a tray off the thing and go out. They were to slide them off. I couldn't see this thing. To me, it was a hazard. And I expressed my feeling that it was a hazard. I had lots of sore toes banging in this thing, you know. It didn't do the wood any harm, but it hurt my feet. And this little girl was a weak little girl. And she could only handle her tray by lifting it gently off this thing and then going out with it. It seems that finally one day there was an accident. And they said, Gerd is right, that thing goes out. And tonight, I had won my victory. But it was like gall in my mouth afterwards. Because this girl said to me what she really thought of me, and I didn't like it, so I had to revert back and tell her what I thought of her. And it wasn't very pretty. That night when I left for the job, I said, my God, why? Here I am trying to practice the 12 steps to the best of my ability. This morning I asked you for help, and here I am in this mess. Why? I had no desire to go out and get drunk. I was very fortunate. But I could have. On the following Friday, I went to my Friday morning meeting. It was the only meeting I could make in all the time I was in Florida. It was once a week. They were all women. Alcoholics. I told them the story. They in turn helped me. I must apologize. It took me quite a few days because she was still giving me dirty looks. And I was still giving them back. Finally, one Saturday. It was a week, about 6 or 7 days it lasted. And I was sitting there having a cigarette, and Ruby, a non-alcoholic, came through and took one look at me, and I at her. And she came over and extended her hand to me, and she says, Gerd, who's going to be the biggest one? You or me? I apologized. And we stood there bawling, you know. All emotional. How silly could you be? How could we fight like this, such dear friends? Now we were sweethearts, practically, you know what I mean? It's these little things. In this program, we are trying to learn to control these things. We're a potential drunk every morning. We ask God's help for this day to keep us sober. We try to practice these 12 steps to the best of our ability. We ask for His will, not ours. I am very grateful. I am back tonight because I have met several dear friends who have slipped and are not back. I feel very, very sad for them. But I am here tonight as a living example. If you give this program all you've got, and you sincerely honestly want to stay sober. Nothing, but nothing, will deter you from that. There is only one way for us, and that's up. There is only one life for us, and it's this new way of life that's handed to us on a silver platter. This is a gift. I still get angry sometimes, but it isn't the same anymore. I can make a decision today. I'm not afraid of it. I try my best not to commit myself to anything anymore. I'm not interested in the material things. I could be out now working. There were 5 jobs waiting for Alan and I the day that we came in on the farm. And out of those 5 jobs, I don't really want any of them because it means nothing but money. Now, isn't this ridiculous? But this is the truth. On those 5 jobs, I will be working anywhere from 12 to 14 to 16 hours a day. Yes, the money is there. But so is a drunk around the corner. This program and this way of life that I have found means more to me today than all of gold that I could possibly get into my pockets. I have a little home that's paid for. It isn't a $125,000 home with a swimming pool. It's a trailer, but it's home to me. It's paid for. I've got a 57 Chevy, Alan, and I have it. It's paid for. It isn't as pretty as it used to be. It isn't as big as it should be. But it does. I don't owe anything to anybody. I only owe one thing, and that is to God. To serve him to the best of my ability. To work this program to the best of my ability. And if there is any time that I can help a sick alcoholic, please God, may I be ready to do this. In closing, I'd very much like to read you a little prayer that Larry Lawson gave me. It is a prayer I found 9 months ago, or around 9 months ago, after my last drunk. And I've been saying it ever since. Lord, in the quiet of this morning hour, I come to thee for peace, for wisdom, and power. To view the world today with love-filled eyes. Be patient, understanding, gentle, wise. To see beyond what seems to be and know thy children as thou knowest them. And so naught but the good in anyone behold. Make deaf my ears to slander that is told. Silence my lips to aught that is unkind. Let only thoughts that bless dwell in my mind. Let me so kindly be, so full of cheer, that all I meet may feel thy presence near. O clothe me in thy beauty, this I pray. Let me reveal thee, Lord, through all this day. Right now, I particularly want to say one more thing. Thank you, Pete. Thank you for the times you've come out to me. Mary, thanks for not letting me down when I need you most. Pete, as a man, and Mary as a woman, I think are the only two who never gave up on me. God bless you.
the program is designed in this manner.
But as I understand it, AA does not intend to take over the function or the role of the professional physician or the priest or the rabbi or the minister.
No. The people in AA go wherever they choose on the outside. Our program is just designed to help them stop drinking. We're not doctors or lawyers or priests or ministers. We are alcoholics. This is how it works, is alcoholics can talk to us better than they can talk to their priest, doctor, lawyer, or minister. And usually when they call us, it's because they want to stop drinking, so this makes it easier for us.
Then I must assume that those of you who work full-time in this office, as well as others in the organization, have at one time been alcoholics, and they share, these people who come to you, the same experience and feel that they can communicate with you.
Well, this is right. I was an alcoholic. I've been a member of AA for 16 years now, but the people that we talk to, we know what they're talking about, and they know that we know what they're talking about, so they feel they get an understanding right away, and this is the reason that this office uses only members of AA to work here.
Well, Gene, maybe you could tell us, how does AA work? What kind of techniques do they use?
Well, it's very hard to say how it works. All I can say is it does work. We share our experiences and our strength and our hope with each other. When I say our experiences, this is where we sit down among ourselves and we tell what our life used to be like and what it's like today.
Peggy answered our next question. How does a person find AA, Alcoholics Anonymous?
Well, through the phone directory, it's the second number in the first page, Woodward 16982, and you call us, and then we in turn get a hold of somebody that lives in your area, and they make contact and get you started to the meeting.
Okay, now we've gotten the word meeting out in the air and talking about getting together. Gene, what happens at that first meeting? I get there, what do I find?
Well, you find a bunch of people that's sitting around drinking coffee and discussing their problem, their drinking problem. When you go to these meetings, you find people are shaking hands. This is one of the things that make you feel very good at first, to know that here are some people that's willing to shake your hand, something that we probably hadn't had in a long time. And then we sit around and we share our experiences with each other. We talk on different phases of our program, which the first part of our program is admittance phase. That is where we admit that we have a problem with alcohol. Then our second part is our spiritual part. And then our third part is our inventory part. This is where we look into ourselves and find out, do we have a problem? Do we want to do something about our problem? Then the third part of our program is what we call active work. This is the service of the program. This is where, after going through the other phases of the program, we are ready now to go out and try to help the fellow alcoholic who still suffers.
And I presume actually you're helping yourself at the same time. Are these the 12 steps that are referred to?
These are the 12 steps that are referred to.
Uh-huh. Thank you, Gene. Let me go back now to Arnie and ask if you would like to cover perhaps in detail these 12 steps that form, or do they form the basis of the Alcoholics Anonymous approach?
They are the basis of the Alcoholics Anonymous approach. They were put together by about the first 100 men that were members of AA, and they are, well, it's pretty hard to bring them all into focus. They're up here.
I see them on the wall. Now, let me take just a moment to look at this, the 12 steps, and I'll read them. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. And this, I presume, opens the door for all faiths and those who are non-believers. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
These steps aren't as difficult as you might think. There is an entirely new way of life for all of us. And we find that we believe in them. We build our lives, rebuild our lives around them. And I know for a fact that AA will work for anybody that wants help, if they'll let it. It worked for me, and it's still working for me.
Well, this may seem to be a presumptuous question, but what kinds of people do you find coming to AA? Do they come just from one walk of life, from one social background? Who would like to respond to that? Arnie?
Well, they come from everywhere. We have professional people, and we have people that you might call a down-and-out bum, really, that comes to AA. They call from anywhere. They walk in here from anywhere, any walk of life, any race, color, or creed. If they have a drinking problem, then they can find their answers here. This is where they come. If we can take care of these 12 steps today, we stay sober today. If it's a lifelong job, it sounds a little harder, but to do it one day or 1 hour at a time, it's not too hard.
When I contribute to the torch drive, am I contributing to AA?
You are not contributing to AA. You might be contributing to some hospital that might have an alcoholic ward or something of this nature, but not to Alcohol Anonymous itself. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. As it states in our preamble, we are self-supporting through our own contribution.
We wondered about those who travel yet need the help AA provides. Asking the question, what if I were in San Francisco and couldn't attend the meeting scheduled in Detroit?
You contact AA. Anybody that's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous has friends all over the world. Wherever there is an AA group, that's your group. And all you have to do is contact the central office in whatever city or you happen to be, and there's meetings.
Then apparently in the phone book I'm going to find AA listed all over the country, all over the world.
I would just like to add, we have what we call a world directory. Usually every group has one. If a person in a group is going on a vacation or something, they can look in this book, and from there they can see where there's a meeting or where there's a representative of this group in this individual city. And this is where they make their contact to attend their meetings.
Do you find that most of the members continue to need help over a long haul, a long period of time? Do they stay members of AA over a period of years? Or is it the kind of an organization where some of them can be helped in a matter of months? Arnie?
Well, one of the biggest things that happens to people that have been sober for quite a few years and all of a sudden they might have a little trouble with their drinking again is the fact that they stopped attending AA meetings. Nobody makes them attend, but continuance of AA meetings assures their sobriety. When they get away from the program, their thinking changes sometimes and they go back to drinking. So they don't have to attend, but most members keep on attending. And there are some that can get away and not take a drink, but most of the people that do take a drink after long periods of sobriety say they stopped attending meetings.
What about this business of the ratio of success to the number of people who enter the program?
We feel that 75% of the people that call AA and say, I want to do something about my drinking problem, will be successful. 50% right away, and another 25% might have a little trouble. and this is the ratio of success with AA. But now we have so many people that come through, judges force them, probation officers force them, marriage counselors tell them to go, the wife is going to divorce them, or many priests or ministers send them to us. And some of these people that come here under pressure, out of this bunch, I would say our success is maybe only 10%. But still, they have had an introduction, and they may come back later. But out of the people that call AA and want to stop drinking, 75% of them can.
Peggy, do we find many women members participating in AA?
Well, there's more than there used to be, and I'm quite sure that there are a lot of women that need it, but they hesitate to call. And there's one thing I wish everybody could understand, that there's no shame attached to alcoholism if you want to do something about it. And quite a few women, I'm sure, are alcoholics in their own kitchens, and this, we can't get to them. We have to wait until the message is carried to them by way of somebody else, or maybe a message like this. And I know that women can be helped. They're good workers, and they do stay sober, and they rebuild their lives.
Well, how can I recognize that I have an alcoholic problem? I know many people consider themselves, and we use that phrase, social drinkers. Gene, how do you suggest a person recognizes he's got a problem and that he should turn to an organization like AA?
Well, one way that I can suggest a person recognize it is, as we say in the program, it's not how much you drink, but what it does to you. Now, some people, they can drink a fifth and nothing happens, and some people can maybe drink a couple of drinks and maybe they black out, they have a loss of memory, or they get into fights, they get into arguments, their whole mental attitude changes just maybe from two or three drinks. So it is quite hard sometimes to recognize that you do have a problem. Or usually we say that a person has to go down to their low. And when we mean low, we mean down to a bottom. When you hit a certain bottom, then you're ready to try to seek some kind of help. A lot of people, they come in because they have been forced, like Arnie said. They lose their jobs, so they want to get their jobs back. Or the court sends them, or the probation department, or divorce counselors, or something of this nature. And then a lot of people, they find out that they're just tired of being drunk and not knowing what's happening, where they've been, or what they've did, or how come they act the way they do, and they seek help.
Now, we don't have any physicians here, any doctors, but you people are so close to the problem, maybe you can give us an answer to this question. Are there any drugs that can be used? Is there any objective, definitive treatment that you people are familiar with in hospitals or other kinds of medical services, Arnie?
There are alcoholic hospitals, and there are hospitals around the certain cities. This is one thing that Detroit lacks, and we don't have any place really to put a sick person unless they have money. But alcoholic hospitals have treatments that they can help them with the physical sickness. They can help them get over the shakes. I don't know, always some use one method and some use another. But they do have methods that they can keep them going into DTs and things like this nowadays. But in AA, we don't try to tell them exactly how to do these things because we're not doctors and we can't. But these alcoholic hospitals do have ways that they can get people off, but most of them cost from $30 to $35 a day to stay in. And really, for the guy on the street that has no insurance or anything else, there's really no place to put him. This is one of the big problems.
Aren't the courts now recognizing that alcoholism is a medical problem, whereas they have previously simply been arresting people who were found drunk in public and putting them in the tank and not giving them medical care? Isn't there coming about a change in the attitude of the courts toward this?
Well, they talk about it a lot, then their attitude has changed, but they still have no place to put them. There's not really, there's a rehabilitation center in Detroit, but it's no place for anybody to stay. They can just refer them there. But we have our program going. If they do send them to the Detroit House of Correction, which is DeHoco, we have AA meetings out there. There's an alcoholism counselor. And there is ways, and a lot of times if the judge can recognize that this fellow just has a drinking problem, he'll just suspend sentence and tell him, why don't you get in touch with AA? Or a lot of times the judge will say, I'll put you on probation for 60 days and you go to AA. And this is the way the courts are dealing with this, but they have no center to really send them off.
Perhaps another way of saying it is this is one of, unfortunately, too many areas in our society where we continue to talk about things, but are not prepared to pay the cost, the dollars and cents that it takes to provide the facilities to begin to meet a recognized need. Next, we asked, what is the first question a new member usually asks?
Well, he usually wants to know, how did I stop drinking? And what am I doing to keep from drinking today? So then I start explaining to him that how I attend AA meetings and how, as it been mentioned, this is a new way of life for me. Like I started to say earlier, all through my days, mostly all I knew was drinking. So once after I got sober, well, quite naturally, I seen an entirely different life. And this was the kind of life that I liked. So I really didn't have too much of a problem staying sober. And this is what I try to explain to a new person. When we have a 12-step call or anything in the program, we call them pigeons. And we go out and we talk to them and we explain to them about ourselves, and then we listen to them and let them explain by themselves about themselves.
Well, the one element that I sense is missing here today, and I suppose we certainly should note it, we have you people who are participating and very familiar with AA, but I'm sure that there are untold numbers out there who themselves have not participated, but relatives and friends of theirs have, and these are the people that we should have here today congratulating this organization for the work that it does. These are the people who endlessly benefit, as well as the individual who himself is involved. And so, inasmuch as they're not here, let me thank you on their behalf and represent them today. Thank you very much, and if there's anything at all that anyone wants to add about AA that you think would help anyone out there, let me give you this opportunity to say it.
If any of you have any idea that you might have a drinking problem, if you have any kind of guilt about your drinking, then it's time to call AA and find out. This is all I can say, because it works.
And Peggy, what is that number in the Detroit area?
Woodward 16982.
Thank you very much. This has been Detroit Close-Up, AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. This is Shelby Newhouse, your host this morning, inviting you to listen next Sunday when Detroit Close-Up reviews The March of Dimes.